from KQED.
This is the California Report podcast. I'm Sonia Hudson.
And I'm Lily Jamali. And just after midnight, PG&E filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The utility says it has no choice as it contends with tens of billions of dollars in potential liabilities stemming from our state's recent wildfires. KQED's Marisa Lagos joins me now. Hi, Marisa.
Good morning.
Let's start with the main takeaways from this filing that came out overnight.
I mean, no huge surprises here. I think one of the things that stands out is that PG&E says that it still has more assets on the books than debts. But basically, they're arguing that they cannot pay the bills. They need financing in order to do that. And so a big part of this is to ask the court to approve over $5 billion in special sort of bankruptcy-related financing from major banks.
To get through this cash crunch that they say they have in the first installment of that DIP financing or bankruptcy.
Exactly. And they are saying that in order to do that, they want to keep paying wages and benefits and keep the lights on.
And the first installment could come in the next, day or so. This is going to affect, of course, payouts that wildfire victims get from lawsuits against the utility. Here's attorney Steve Skikos, who represents survivors of the 2017 North Bay fires. We spoke with him this morning.
I don't think this is going to change the ultimate outcome, but we have a lot of work to do, especially because we need a California solution to this California problem and not a Wall Street cram down.
Now, he maintains that this will not affect payouts ultimately in the end. What are lawmakers in Sacramento saying?
I think disappointed is the word that's being used the most. I think it's questionable whether wildfire victims will be made as whole as they would have been if there had not been a bankruptcy filing. I think the state's going to do everything it can to sort of pressure the court to keep them whole. But, it's up to a judge now.
And I want to take our listeners to an emergency meeting called yesterday by the state utility regulator, the California Public Utilities Commission, which was greeted by an angry crowd. Take a listen.
Clerk will please call the roll. Please call the roll. Could you? Yes, thank you.
And
call
that,
the roll.
Item one.
That's CPUC Chair Michael Picker. This is the state agency that oversees the utility. What happened at that meeting? There's concern that ratepayers could ultimately foot the bill here.
Yeah, so that was an unusual meeting where they called basically to approve that financing we talked about. I think that it really remains to be seen whether or not the CPUC can really protect ratepayers in the next 2 to 3 years as this proceeds.
KQED's Marisa Lagos, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
All right, we have new details now this morning on the amount of insurance claims stemming from November's campfire in Butte County. The number has now reached $11.4 billion. That's 25% higher than last month. State Insurance Commissioner Ricardo Lara says those numbers will likely rise.
This is unprecedented for us, and we're going to continue to monitor as we're going to continue to see uptick in the fire losses. And this is just for insured.
Lara says about half of the campfire claims have been paid so far. The blaze killed 86 people and leveled more than 18,000 structures. It's the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in recorded state history. When combined with claims from the earlier Carr and Mendocino complex fires, the latest figures bring total insured losses to $12.4 billion for 2018.
We're going to go to Sacramento now, where a number of state lawmakers are pushing for a constitutional amendment that would allow people on parole in California to vote. California Secretary of State Alex Padilla joined legislators in the state capitol yesterday in support of including nearly 50,000 former inmates in the electoral process. Padilla says Californians on parole for a felony conviction currently cannot vote in state, federal, or local elections.
Parole period is an integral part of somebody successfully transitioning back to a community. So this measure makes sense both from a voting rights standpoint and from a public safety standpoint.
Padilla says the move builds off of a 2015 law that restored voting rights to low-level offenders released under community supervision after realignment. If successful in the legislature, the issue heads to voters as a ballot measure.
Let's move on now to immigration. A federal judge in San Diego has ordered the Trump administration to respond by Friday to a report that Homeland Security officials may have separated thousands more migrant children from their parents than initially reported. KQED's Julie Small explains.
Last June, Judge Dana Sabra barred family separations and ordered the government to reunite roughly 2,700 children with their families. Nearly all of those kids have been returned to a parent or released to relatives or sponsors. But earlier this month, the Inspector General for the agency responsible for migrant children, the Department of Health and Human Services, found that there have been hundreds or possibly thousands more separations. ACLU attorney Lee Gallant urged the court to take another look.
We need to get to the bottom of all these families that were separated in the past, but we also, equally important, need to put into place processes going forward so that we have a full accounting.
The government acknowledges it is still separating some children when it deems their parents to be a danger, but Gallant doesn't believe those separations are being properly tracked.
Children are being dropped off at shelters, and the workers at the shelter are not being told whether the child actually came to this country without anybody or came with a parent and was separated.
The Department of Homeland Security did not immediately respond to a request for comment. For the California Report, I'm Julie Small.
We're going to head now to San Luis Obispo County, where public comment is wrapping up on an offshore wind farm proposal near Morro Bay. Now, this is a big deal because there aren't any offshore wind farms approved off of California's coast, at least not yet. But this may change in the next few years as the state works towards its green energy goals. KCBX's Greta Mart explains.
In late November, the city of Morro Bay and local fishermen approved an economic development agreement with Castle Wind, an offshore wind developer. No project has been greenlighted, but Scott Collins, Morro Bay city manager, says the company was smart to get buy-in on the front end.
If they get the bid, if they're successful, that there wouldn't be lawsuits. I mean, quite frankly, that's what the East Coast has experienced, where projects were let and then none of this legwork was completed, and it's held up in court for 5 to 10 years.
The agency that would permit any wind farm off California is the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, or BOEM. It approves leasing areas off America's coast for gas and oil exploration and renewable energy. BOEM and the California Energy Commission have identified three areas for wind farms offshore near San Luis Obispo and Morro Bay on the Central Coast and near Eureka in Humboldt County. Jean Thurston is a renewable energy specialist with BOEM.
And there's limited places offshore California where you can actually do offshore wind energy.
What do you need?
You need greater than 7 meters per second wind speed for it to be economically viable for a developer.
Offshore wind farms are new territory for California. West Coast waters get very deep, very close to shore. Although turbines are built into shallow seabeds elsewhere, here they would have to be floating, tethered in place by chains reaching down as deep as 3,000 feet and held in place by giant anchors. Some projects could have up to 100 turbines. Marine biologist Benjamin Ruttenberg directs the Center for Coastal Marine Sciences in San Luis Obispo, where BOEM funds research. He says the impacts on marine life will need to be studied thoroughly.
I mean, we think about lots of other things, but the main factors that we think that are going to be the biggest concerns are going to be the marine mammals, seabirds, fish populations, critters that hang out on the bottom.
Offshore wind farms are only feasible in about 6% of the water off California's coast, but there are a lot of groups that could use that 6%. Fishermen, shipping, the Navy. Here's BOEM's Thurston again.
Now we know, looking at all the areas offshore that are viable, there's no area that's going to be conflict-free. So we're trying to look at areas that have the least amount of conflict.
Kristen Hislop is with the Environmental Defense Center, which has some ideas on how to research, study, and monitor offshore wind farms.
We haven't taken a stance on whether or not we're for or against offshore wind, but we are very interested in being part of the process.
BOEM is wrapping up a public comment period on the three areas identified for wind farms. Next comes environmental review. So it'll likely be a few years before there are any wind turbines generating power off California's coast. For the California Report, I'm Greta Mar in San Luis Obispo.
And that's the California Report for Tuesday, January 29th, a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Sonia Hudson.
And I'm Lily Jamali. Have a great day.
Support for the California Report comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose Fund for Strategic Innovation supports transformative ideas that benefit humanity while protecting the natural world, recognizing through science the interdependence of all living systems. The James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. And Collective Health. American employers are in the healthcare business. It's time they had the technology to drive it. CollectiveHealth.com.